Chapter 12. In this way, the second phase began. It was as though he had fallen into a sewer. As upon another life, he looked back upon that first hard and manlike surrender, that surrender terrific and hard, like the breaking down of a spiritual skeleton, the very sound of whose snapping fibers could be heard almost by the physical ear, so that the act of capitulation was anticlimax. As when a defeated general, on the day after the last battle, shaved overnight and with his boots cleaned of the mud of combat, surrenders his sword to a committee. The sewer ran only by night. The days were the same as they'd ever been. He went to work at 6:30 in the morning. He would leave the cabin without looking toward the house at all. At 6 in the evening he returned, again without even looking toward the house. He washed and changed to the white shirt and the dark creased trousers, and went to the kitchen and found his supper waiting on the table, and he sat and ate it, still without having seen her at all. But he knew that she was in the house, and that the coming of dark within the old walls was breaking down something and leaving it corrupt with waiting. He knew how she'd spent the day, that her days were no different from what they'd always been, as if in her case, too, another person had lived them. All day long he would imagine her, going about her housework, sitting for that unvarying period at the scarred desk, or talking, listening, to the negro women who came to the house from both directions, up and down the road, following paths which had been years in the wearing, and which radiated from the house like wheel spokes. What they talked about to her he didn't know, though he had watched them approaching the house in a manner not exactly secret, yet purposeful, entering usually singly, though sometimes in twos and threes, in their aprons and head rags, and now and then with a man's coat thrown about their shoulders, emerging again and returning down the radiating paths, not fast and yet not loitering. They would be brief in his mind, thinking, "Now she's doing this. Now she's doing that," not thinking much about her. He believed that during the day she thought no more about him than he did about her, too. Even when at night in her dark bedroom she insisted on telling him in tedious detail the trivial matters of her day, and insisted on his telling her of his day in turn, it was in the fashion of lovers. That imperious and insatiable demand that the trivial details of both days be put into words, without any need to listen to the telling. Then he would finish his supper and go to her where she waited. Often he wouldn't hurry. As time went on and the novelty of the second phase began to wear off and become habit, he would stand in the kitchen door and look out across the dusk and see, perhaps with foreboding and premonition, the savage and lonely street, which he'd chosen of his own will, waiting for him, thinking, "This isn't my life. I don't belong here." At first, it shocked him, the abject fury of the New England glacier exposed suddenly to the fire of the New England biblical hell. Perhaps he was aware of the abnegation in it, the imperious and fierce urgency that concealed an actual despair at frustrate and irrevocable years, which she appeared to attempt to compensate each night as if she believed that it would be the last night on earth, by damning herself forever to the hell of her forefathers, by living not alone in sin but in filth. She had an avidity for the forbidden word symbols, an insatiable appetite for the sound of them on his tongue and on her own. She revealed the terrible and impersonal curiosity of a child about forbidden subjects and objects, that rapt and tireless and detached interest of a surgeon in the physical body and its possibilities. And by day he would see the calm, cold-faced, almost manlike, almost middle-aged woman who'd lived for 20 years alone without any feminine fears at all, in a lonely house in a neighborhood populated, when at all, by negroes, who spent a certain portion of each day sitting tranquilly at a desk and writing tranquilly for the eyes of both youth and age, the practical advice of a combined priest and banker and trained nurse. During that period, it couldn't be called a honeymoon, Christmas watched her pass through every avatar of a woman in love. Soon she more than shocked him. She astonished and bewildered him. She surprised and took him unawares with fits of jealous rage. She could have had no such experience at all, and there was neither reason for the scene nor any possible protagonist. He knew that she knew that. It was as if she'd invented the whole thing deliberately, for the purpose of playing it out like a play. Yet she did it with such fury, with such convincingness and such conviction, that on the first occasion he thought that she was under a delusion, and the third time he thought that she was mad. She revealed an unexpected and infallible instinct for intrigue. She insisted on a place for concealing notes, letters. It was in a hollow fence post below the rotting stable. He never saw her put a note there, yet she insisted on his visiting it daily. When he did so, the letter would be there. When he didn't and lied to her, he would find that she'd already set traps to catch him in the lie. She cried, wept. Sometimes the notes would tell him not to come until a certain hour, to that house which no white person save himself had entered in years, and in which, for 20 years now, she'd been all night alone. For a whole week, she forced him to climb into a window to come to her. He would do so, and sometimes he would have to seek her about the dark house until he found her, hidden in closets, in empty rooms, waiting, panting, her eyes in the dark glowing like the eyes of cats. Now and then she appointed trysts beneath certain shrubs about the grounds, where he would find her naked, or with her clothing half torn to ribbons upon her, in the wild throes of nymphomania, her body gleaming in the slow shifting from one to another of such formerly erotic attitudes and gestures as a Beardsley of the time of Petronius might have drawn. She would be wild then, in the close, breathing half-dark without walls, with her wild hair, each strand of which would seem to come alive like octopus tentacles, and her wild hands and her breathing, "Negro, Negro, Negro." Within 6 months, she was completely corrupted. It couldn't be said that he corrupted her. His own life, for all its anonymous promiscuity, had been conventional enough, as a life of healthy and normal sin usually is. The corruption came from a source even more inexplicable to him than to her. In fact, it was as though with the corruption which she seemed to gather from the air itself, she began to corrupt him. He began to be afraid. He couldn't have said of what, but he began to see himself as from a distance, like a man being sucked down into a bottomless morass. He hadn't exactly thought that yet. What he was now seeing was the street, lonely, savage, and cool. That was it. Cool. He was thinking, saying aloud to himself sometimes, "I better move. I better get away from here." But something held him, as the fatalist can always be held, by curiosity, pessimism, by sheer inertia. Meanwhile, the affair went on, submerging him more and more by the imperious and overriding fury of those nights. Perhaps he realized that he couldn't escape. Anyway, he stayed, watching the two creatures that struggled in the one body, like two moon-gleamed shapes struggling, drowning, in alternate throes upon the surface of a black, thick pool beneath the last moon. Now it would be that still, cold, contained figure of the first phase, who, even though lost and damned, remains somehow impervious and impregnable. Then it would be the other, the second one, who, in furious denial of that impregnability, strove to drown in the black abyss of its own creating that physical purity which had been preserved too long now even to be lost. Now and then they would come to the black surface, locked like sisters. The black waters would drain away. Then the world would rush back, the room, the walls, the peaceful myriad sound of insects from beyond the summer windows where insects had whirred for 40 years. She would stare at him then, with the wild, despairing face of a stranger. Looking at her, he paraphrased himself, "She wants to pray, but she don't know how to do that either." She had begun to get fat. The end of this phase wasn't sharp, not a climax like the first. It merged into the third phase so gradually that he couldn't have said where one stopped and the other began. It was summer becoming fall, with already, like shadows before a westering sun, the chill and implacable import of autumn cast ahead upon summer. Something of dying summer spurting again like a dying coal in the fall. This was over a period of 2 years. He still worked at the planing mill, and in the meantime he'd begun to sell a little whiskey, very judiciously restricting himself to a few discreet customers, none of whom knew the others. She didn't know this, although he kept his stock hidden on the place and met his clients in the woods beyond the pasture. Very likely she wouldn't have objected, but neither would Mrs. McEachern have objected to the hidden rope. Perhaps he didn't tell her for the same reason that he didn't tell Mrs. McEachern. Thinking of Mrs. McEachern and the rope, and of the waitress, whom he'd never told where the money came from which he gave her, and now of his present mistress and the whiskey, he could almost believe that it wasn't to make money that he sold the whiskey, but because he was doomed to conceal always something from the women who surrounded him. Meanwhile, he would see her from a distance now and then in the daytime, about the rear premises, where moved, articulate beneath the clean, austere garments which she wore, that rotten richness ready to flow into putrefaction at a touch, like something growing in a swamp, not once looking toward the cabin or toward him. And when he thought of that other personality that seemed to exist somewhere in physical darkness itself, it seemed to him that what he now saw by daylight was a phantom of someone whom the night sister had murdered, and which now moved purposeless about the scenes of old peace, robbed even of the power of lamenting. Of course, the first fury of the second phase couldn't last. At first it had been a torrent, now it was a tide, with a flow and ebb. During its flood, she could almost fool them both. It was as if out of her knowledge that it was just a flow that must presently react was born a wilder fury, a fierce denial that could flag itself and him into physical experimentation that transcended imagining, carried them as though by momentum alone, bearing them without volition or plan. It was as if she knew somehow that time was short, that autumn was almost upon her, without knowing yet the exact significance of autumn. It seemed to be instinct alone, instinct physical and instinctive denial of the wasted years. Then the tide would ebb. Then they would be stranded as behind a dying mistral, upon a spent and satiate beach, looking at one another like strangers, with hopeless and reproachful, on his part with weary, on hers with despairing, eyes. But the shadow of autumn was upon her. She began to talk about a child, as though instinct had warned her that now was the time when she must either justify or expiate. She talked about it in the ebb periods. At first, the beginning of the night was always a flood, as if the hours of light and of separation had dammed up enough of the wasting stream to simulate torrent for a moment at least. But after a while, the stream became too thin for that. He would go to her now with reluctance, a stranger already back-looking, a stranger he would leave her after having sat with her in the dark bedroom, talking of still a third stranger. He noticed now how, as though by premeditation, they met always in the bedroom, as though they were married. No more did he have to seek her through the house, the nights when he must seek her, hidden and panting and naked, about the dark house or among the shrubbery of the ruined park, were as dead now as the hollow fence-post below the barn. That was all dead, the scenes, the faultlessly played scenes of secret and monstrous delight and of jealousy. Though if she'd but known it now, she had reason for jealousy. He made trips every week or so on business, he told her. She didn't know that the business took him to Memphis, where he betrayed her with other women. Women bought for a price. She didn't know it. Perhaps in the phase in which she now was, she couldn't have been convinced, wouldn't have listened to proof, wouldn't have cared. Because she'd taken to lying sleepless most of the night, making up the sleep in the afternoons. She wasn't sick. It wasn't her body. She'd never been better. Her appetite was enormous, and she weighed 30 pounds more than she'd ever weighed in her life. It wasn't that that kept her awake. It was something out of the darkness, the earth, the dying summer itself. Something threatful and terrible to her because instinct assured her that it wouldn't harm her. That it would overtake and betray her completely, but she wouldn't be harmed. That on the contrary, she would be saved, that life would go on the same and even better, even less terrible. What was terrible was that she didn't want to be saved. "I'm not ready to pray yet," she said aloud, quietly, rigid, soundless, her eyes wide open while the moon poured and poured into the window, filling the room with something cold and irrevocable and wild with regret. "Don't make me have to pray yet. Dear God, let me be damned a little longer, a little while." She seemed to see her whole past life, the starved years like a gray tunnel, at the far and irrevocable end of which, as unfading as a reproach, her naked breast of 3 short years ago ached as though in agony, virgin and crucified. "Not yet. Dear God, not yet. Dear God." So when he now came to her, after the passive and cold and seemly transports of sheer habit, she began to speak of a child. She talked about it impersonally at first, discussing children. Perhaps it was sheer and instinctive feminine cunning and indirection, perhaps not. Anyway, it was some time before he discovered with a kind of shock that she was discussing it as a possibility, a practical thought. He said no at once. "Why not?" she said. She looked at him, speculative. He was thinking fast, thinking, "She wants to be married. That's it, she wants a child no more than I do. It's just a trick," he thought. "I should have known it, expected it. I should have cleared out of here a year ago." But he was afraid to tell her this, to let the word marriage come between them, come aloud, thinking, "She may not have thought of it, and I'll just put the notion in her head." She was watching him. "Why not?" she said. And then something in him flashed. "Why not? It would mean ease, security for the rest of your life. You'd never have to move again. And you might as well be married to her as this..." Thinking, "No. If I give in now, I will deny all the 30 years that I have lived to make me what I chose to be." He said, "If we were going to have one, I guess we would have had one 2 years ago." "We didn't want one then." "We don't want one now, either," he said. That was in September. Just after Christmas, she told him that she was pregnant. Almost before she ceased to speak, he believed that she was lying. He discovered now that he'd been expecting her to tell him that for 3 months. But when he looked at her face, he knew that she wasn't. He believed that she also knew that she wasn't. He thought, Here it comes. She'll say it now. Marry. But I can at least get out of the house first. But she didn't. She was sitting quite still on the bed, her hands on her lap, her still New England face. It was still the face of a spinster, prominently boned, long, a little thin, almost manlike. In contrast to it, her plump body was more richly and softly animal than ever, lowered. She said in a tone musing, detached, impersonal, "A full measure, even to a bastard Negro child. I would like to see Father's and Calvin's faces. This would be a good time for you to run, if that's what you want to do." But it was as though she weren't listening to her own voice, didn't intend for the words to have any actual meaning. That final upflare of stubborn and dying summer upon which autumn, the dawning of half-death, had come unawares. "It's over now," she thought quietly. "Finished. Except the waiting. For 1 month more to pass. To be sure. She'd learned that from the Negro women, that you couldn't always tell until after 2 months. She would have to wait another month, watching the calendar. She made a mark on the calendar, to be sure, so there would be no mistake. Through the bedroom window, she watched that month accomplish. A frost had come, and some of the leaves were beginning to turn. The marked day on the calendar came and passed. She gave herself another week, to be doubly sure. She wasn't elated, since she wasn't surprised. "I am with child," she said quietly, aloud. "I'll go tomorrow," he told himself that same day. "I'll go Sunday," he thought. "I'll wait and get this week's pay, and then I'm gone." He began to look forward to Saturday, planning where he would go. He didn't see her all that week. He expected her to send for him. When he entered or left the cabin, he would find himself avoiding looking toward the house, as he had during the first week he was there. He didn't see her at all. Now and then he would see the Negro women in nondescript garments against the autumn chill, coming or going along the worn paths, entering or leaving the house. But that was all. When Saturday came, he didn't go. "Might as well have all the jack I can get," he thought. "If she ain't anxious for me to clear out, no reason why I should be. I'll go next Saturday." He stayed on. The weather remained cold, bright and cold. When he went to bed now in his cotton blanket in the drafty cabin, he would think of the bedroom in the house with its fire, its ample, quilted, lint-padded covers. He was nearer to self-pity than he'd ever been. "She might at least send me another blanket," he thought. So might he have bought one. But he didn't. Neither did she. He waited. He waited what he thought was a long time. Then one evening in February he returned home and found a note from her on his cot. It was brief. It was an order, almost, directing him to come to the house that night. He wasn't surprised. He'd never yet known a woman who, without another man available, wouldn't come around in time. And he knew now that tomorrow he would go. "This must be what I've been waiting for," he thought. "I've just been waiting to be vindicated." When he changed his clothes, he shaved also. He prepared himself like a bridegroom, unaware of it. He found the table set for him in the kitchen as usual. During all the time that he hadn't seen her, that had never failed. He ate and went upstairs. He didn't hurry. "We got all night," he thought. "It'll be something for her to think about tomorrow night and the next one when she finds that cabin empty." She was sitting before the fire. She didn't even turn her head when he entered. bring that chair up with you?" she said. This was how the third phase began. It puzzled him for a while, even more than the other two. He'd expected eagerness, a kind of tacit apology, or lacking that, an acquiescence that wanted only to be wooed. He was prepared to go to that length, even. What he found was a stranger, who put aside with the calm firmness of a man his hand, when at last, and in a kind of baffled desperation, he went and touched her. "Come on," he said. "If you have something to tell me, we always talk better afterward. It won't hurt the kid if that's what you've been afraid of." She stayed him with a single word. For the first time, he looked at her face. He looked upon a face cold, remote, and fanatic. "Do you realize," she said, "that you are wasting your life?" And he sat looking at her like a stone, as if he couldn't believe his own ears. It took him some time to comprehend what she meant. She didn't look at him at all. She sat looking into the fire, her face cold, still, brooding, talking to him as if he were a stranger, while he listened in outraged amazement. She wanted him to take over all her business affairs, the correspondence and the periodical visits with the Negro schools. She had the plan all elaborated. She recited it to him in detail while he listened in mounting rage and amazement. He was to have complete charge, and she would be his secretary, assistant. They would travel to the schools together, visit in the Negro homes together. Listening, even with his anger, he knew that the plan was mad. And all the while her calm profile in the peaceful firelight was as grave and tranquil as a portrait in a frame. When he left, he remembered that she hadn't once mentioned the expected child. He didn't yet believe that she was mad. He thought that it was because she was pregnant, as he believed that was why she wouldn't let him touch her. He tried to argue with her, but it was like trying to argue with a tree. She didn't even rouse herself to deny. She just listened quietly, and then talked again in that level, cold tone, as if he had never spoken. When he rose at last and went out, he didn't even know if she was aware that he had gone. He saw her but once more within the next 2 months. He followed his daily routine, save that he didn't approach the house at all now, taking his meals downtown again, as when he'd first gone to work at the mill. But then, when he first went to work, he wouldn't need to think of her during the day. He hardly ever thought about her. Now he couldn't help himself. She was in his mind so constantly that it was almost as if he were looking at her, there in the house, patient, waiting, inescapable, crazy. During the first phase, it had been as though he were outside a house where snow was on the ground, trying to get into the house. During the second phase, he was at the bottom of a pit in the hot, wild darkness. Now, he was in the middle of a plain where there was no house, not even snow, not even wind. He began now to be afraid, whose feeling up to now had been bewilderment and perhaps foreboding and fatality. He now had a partner in his whiskey business, a stranger named Brown, who'd appeared at the mill one day early in the spring seeking work. He knew that the man was a fool, but at first he thought, "At least he'll have sense enough to do what I tell him to do. He won't have to think himself at all." It wasn't until later that he said to himself, "I know now that what makes a fool is an inability to take even his own good advice." He took Brown because Brown was a stranger and had a certain cheerful and unscrupulous readiness about him, and not overmuch personal courage, knowing that in the hands of a judicious man, a coward within his own limitations can be made fairly useful to anyone except himself. His fear was that Brown might learn about the woman in the house and do something irrevocable out of his own unpredictable folly. He was afraid that the woman, since he had avoided her, might take it into her head to come to the cabin some night. He hadn't seen her but once since February. That was when he sought her to tell her that Brown was coming to live with him in the cabin. It was on Sunday. He called her, and she came out to where he stood on the back porch and listened quietly. "You didn't have to do that," she said. He didn't understand then what she meant. It wasn't until later that thinking again flashed, complete, like a printed sentence. "She thinks that I brought him out here to keep her off. She believes that I think that with him here, she won't dare come down to the cabin. That she'll have to let me alone." Thus, he put his belief, his fear of what she might do, into his own mind by believing that he had put it into hers. He believed that, since she had thought that, Brown's presence would not only not deter her, it would be an incentive for her to come to the cabin. Because of the fact that for over a month now, she had done nothing at all, made no move at all, he believed that she might do anything. Now he, too, lay awake at night. But he was thinking, "I've got to do something. There is something that I am going to do." So he would trick and avoid Brown in order to reach the cabin first. He expected each time to find her waiting. When he would reach the cabin and find it empty, he would think in a kind of impotent rage of the urgency, the lying, and the haste, and of her, alone and idle in the house all day, with nothing to do save to decide whether to betray him at once or torture him a little longer. By ordinary, he wouldn't have minded whether Brown knew about their relations or not. He had nothing in his nature of reticence or of chivalry toward women. It was practical, material. He would have been indifferent if all Jefferson knew he was her lover. It was that he wanted no one to begin to speculate on what his private life out there was because of the hidden whiskey, which was netting him $30 or $40 a week. That was one reason. Another reason was vanity. He would have died or murdered rather than have anyone, another man, learn what their relations had now become. That not only had she changed her life completely, but that she was trying to change his too, and make of him something between a hermit and a missionary to Negroes. He believed that if Brown learned the one, he must inevitably learn the other. So he would reach the cabin at last, after the lying and the hurry, and as he put his hand on the door, remembering the haste, and thinking that in a moment he would find that it hadn't been necessary at all, and yet to neglect which precaution he dared not. He would hate her with a fierce revulsion of dread and impotent rage. Then, one evening, he opened the door and found the note on the cot. He saw it as soon as he entered, lying square and white and profoundly inscrutable against the dark blanket. He didn't even stop to think that he believed he knew what the message would be, would promise. He felt no eagerness, he felt relief. "It's over now," he thought, not yet taking up the folded paper. "It will be like it was before now. No more talking about niggers and babies, she's come around. She has worn the other out, seeing that she was getting nowhere. She sees now that what she wants, needs, is a man. She wants a man by night. What he does by daylight doesn't matter." He should have realized then the reason why he hadn't gone away. He should have seen that he was bound just as tightly by that small square of still undivulging paper as though it were a lock and chain. He didn't think of that. He saw only himself once again on the verge of promise and delight. It would be quieter, though, now. They would both want it so, besides the whip hand which he would now have. All that foolishness, he thought, holding the yet unopened paper in his hands, all that damn foolishness. She's still she, and I'm still I. And now, after all this damn foolishness, thinking how they would both laugh over it tonight, later, afterward, when the time for quiet talking and quiet laughing came, at the whole thing, at one another, at themselves. He didn't open the note at all. He put it away and washed and shaved and changed his clothes, whistling while he did so. He hadn't finished when Brown came in.
Well,
Brown said. Christmas said nothing. He was facing the shard of mirror nailed to the wall, knotting his tie. Brown had stopped in the center of the floor, a tall, lean young man in dirty overalls, with a dark, weakly handsome face and curious eyes. Beside his mouth there was a narrow scar as white as a thread of spittle. After a while, Brown said,
"Looks like you're going somewhere."
"Does it?" Christmas said. He didn't look around. He whistled monotonously but truly, something in minor, plaintive and negroid.
"I reckon I won't bother to clean up none," Brown said, "seeing as you're almost ready."
Christmas looked back at him.
"Ready for what?" "Ain't you going to town?"
"Did I ever say I was?" Christmas said. He turned back to the glass.
"Oh,"
Brown said. He watched the back of Christmas's head.
"Well, I reckon from that you're going on private business."
He watched Christmas.
"This here's a cold night to be laying around on the wet ground without nothing under you but a thin gal."
"Ain't it, though?" Christmas said, whistling, preoccupied and unhurried. He turned and picked up his coat and put it on, Brown still watching him. He went to the door.
"See you in the morning," he said.
The door didn't close behind him. He knew that Brown was standing in it, looking after him, but he didn't attempt to conceal his purpose. He went on toward the house.
"Let him watch," he thought. "Let him follow me if he wants to."
The table was set for him in the kitchen. Before sitting down, he took the unopened note from his pocket and laid it beside his plate. It wasn't enclosed, not sealed. It sprang open of its own accord as though inviting him, insisting. But he didn't look at it. He began to eat. He ate without haste. He'd almost finished when he raised his head suddenly, listening. Then he rose and went to the door through which he'd entered, with the noiselessness of a cat, and jerked the door open suddenly. Brown stood just outside. His face leaned to the door, or where the door had been. The light fell upon his face, and upon it was an expression of intent and infantile interest, which became surprise while Christmas looked at it. Then it recovered, falling back a little. Brown's voice was gleeful, though quiet, cautious, conspiratorial, as if he'd already established his alliance and sympathy with Christmas, unasked, and without waiting to know what was going on, out of loyalty to his partner, or perhaps to abstract man as opposed to all woman.
Well, he said. "So this is where you tomcat to every night. Right at our front door, you might say."
Without saying a word, Christmas struck him. The blow didn't fall hard because Brown was already in innocent and gleeful back motion, in mid-snicker, as it were. The blow cut his voice short off. Moving, springing backward, he vanished from the fall of light into the darkness, from which his voice came, still not loud, as if even now he wouldn't jeopardize his partner's business, but tense now with alarm, astonishment.
"Don't you hit me!"
He was the taller of the two, a gangling shape already in a ludicrous diffusion of escape, as if he were on the point of clattering to earth in complete disintegration, as he stumbled backward before the steady and still silent advance of the other. Again Brown's voice came, high, full of alarm and spurious threat.
"Don't you hit me!"
This time the blow struck his shoulder as he turned. He was running now. He ran for 100 yards before he slowed, looking back. Then he stopped and turned. "You darn yellow-bellied wop," he said in a tentative tone, jerking his head immediately as if his voice had made more noise, sounded louder than he'd intended. There was no sound from the house. The kitchen door was dark again, closed again. He raised his voice a little. "You darn yellow-bellied wop! I'll learn you who you're monkeying with." There came no sound anywhere. It was chilly. He turned and went back to the cabin, mumbling to himself. When Christmas re-entered the kitchen, he didn't even look back at the table on which lay the note which he'd not yet read. He went on through the door which led into the house and onto the stairs. He began to mount, not fast. He mounted steadily. He could now see the bedroom door, a crack of light, firelight, beneath it. He went steadily on and put his hand upon the door. Then he opened it. And he stopped, dead still. She was sitting at a table beneath the lamp. He saw a figure that he knew, in a severe garment that he knew, a garment that looked as if it had been made for and worn by a careless man. Above it, he saw a head with hair just beginning to gray, drawn gauntly back to a knot, as savage and ugly as a wart on a diseased bough. Then she looked up at him, and he saw that she wore steel-rimmed spectacles, which he'd never seen before. He stood in the door, his hand still on the knob, quite motionless. It seemed to him that he could actually hear the words inside him. "You should have read that note. You should have read that note." Thinking, "I'm going to do something. Going to do something." He was still hearing that while he stood beside the table on which papers were scattered, and from which she hadn't risen, and listened to the calm enormity which her cold, still voice unfolded. His mouth repeating the words after her while he looked down at the scattered and enigmatic papers and documents, and thinking fled, smooth and idle, wondering what this paper meant and what that paper meant. "To school," his mouth said. "Yes," she said. "They will take you. Any of them will, on my account. You can choose anyone you want among them. We won't even have to pay." "To school," his mouth said. "A nigger school. Me." "Yes. Then you can go to Memphis. You can read law in Peebles' office. He will teach you law. Then you can take charge of all the legal business. All this, all that he does, Peebles does. And then learn law in the office of a nigger lawyer," his mouth said. "Yes. Then I will turn over all the business to you, all the money. All of it. So that when you need money for yourself, you would know how. Lawyers know how to do it so that it... you would be helping them up out of darkness, and none could accuse or blame you even if they found out. Even if you didn't replace... but you could replace the money, and none would ever know." "But a nigger college, a nigger lawyer," his voice said, quiet, not even argumentative, just promptive. They weren't looking at one another. She hadn't looked up since he entered. "Tell them," she said. "Tell niggers that I am a nigger too." She now looked at him. Her face was quite calm. It was the face of an old woman now. "Yes. You'll have to do that. So they won't charge you anything. On my account." Then, it was as if he said suddenly to his mouth, "Shut up. Shut up, that drivel. Let me talk." He leaned down. She didn't move. Their faces weren't a foot apart, the one cold, dead, white, fanatical, mad. The other, parchment-colored, the lip lifted into the shape of a soundless and rigid snarl. He said quietly, "You're old. I never noticed that before. An old woman. You got gray in your hair." She struck him, at once, with her flat hand, the rest of her body not moving at all. Her blow made a flat sound, his blow as close upon it as echo. He struck with his fist. Then in that long, blowing wind, he jerked her up from the chair and held her, facing him, motionless. Not a flicker upon her still face, while the long wind of knowing rushed down upon him. "You haven't got any baby," he said. "You never had one. There's not anything the matter with you except being old. You just got old, and it happened to you, and now you are not any good anymore. That's all that's wrong with you." He released her and struck her again. She fell, huddled onto the bed, looking up at him, and he struck her in the face again, and standing over her, he spoke to her the words which she'd once loved to hear on his tongue, which she used to say that she could taste there, murmurous, obscene, caressing. "That's all. You're just worn out. You're not any good anymore, that's all." She lay on the bed, on her side, her head turned and looking up at him across her bleeding mouth. "Maybe it would be better if we both were dead," she said. He could see the note lying on the blanket as soon as he opened the door. Then he would go and take it up and open it. He would now remember the hollow fence post as something of which he'd heard told, as having taken place in another life from any that he'd ever lived, because the paper, the ink, the form and shape were the same. They'd never been long, they weren't long now. But now there was nothing evocative of unspoken promise, of rich and unmentionable delights in them. They were now briefer than epitaphs, and more terse than commands. His first impulse would be to not go. He believed that he dared not go. Then he knew that he dared not fail to go. He wouldn't change his clothes now. In his sweat-stained overalls, he would traverse the late twilight of May and enter the kitchen. The table was never set with food for him now. Sometimes he would look at it as he passed, and he'd think, "My God, when have I sat down in peace to eat?" And he couldn't remember. He would go into the house and mount the stairs. Already he'd be hearing her voice. It would increase as he mounted until he reached the door to the bedroom. The door would be shut, locked. From beyond it, the monotonous, steady voice came. He couldn't distinguish the words, only the ceaseless monotone. He dared not try to distinguish the words. He didn't dare let himself know what she was at. So he would stand there and wait, and after a while the voice would cease and she would open the door and he would enter. As he passed the bed he would look down at the floor beside it, and it would seem to him that he could distinguish the prints of knees, and he would jerk his eyes away as if it were death that they'd looked at. Likely the lamp wouldn't yet be lighted. They didn't sit down. Again they stood to talk, as they used to do 2 years ago, standing in the dusk while her voice repeated its tale. "Not to school, then, if you don't want to go. Do without that. Your soul. Expiation of..." And he waiting, cold, still, until she'd finished. "Hell. Forever and ever and ever." "No," he said. And she would listen as quietly, and he knew that she wasn't convinced, and she knew that he wasn't. Yet neither surrendered. Worse, they wouldn't let one another alone. He wouldn't even go away. And they would stand for a while longer in the quiet dusk, peopled, as though from their loins, by a myriad ghosts of dead sins and delights, looking at one another's still and fading face, weary, spent, and indomitable. Then he would leave. And before the door had shut and the bolt had shot to behind him, he would hear the voice again, monotonous, calm, and despairing, saying what and to what or whom he dared not learn nor suspect. And so, as he sat in the shadows of the ruined garden on that August night 3 months later, and heard the clock in the courthouse 2 miles away strike 10, and then 11, he believed with calm paradox that he was the volitionless servant of the fatality in which he believed that he didn't believe. He was saying to himself, I had to do it, already in the past tense. I had to do it. She said so herself. She had said it 2 nights ago. He found the note and went to her. As he mounted the stairs, the monotonous voice grew louder, sounded louder and clearer than usual. When he reached the top of the stairs, he saw why. The door was open this time, and she didn't rise from where she knelt beside the bed when he entered. She didn't stir. Her voice didn't cease. Her head wasn't bowed. Her face was lifted, almost with pride. Her attitude of formal abjectness, a part of the pride. Her voice calm and tranquil and abnegant in the twilight. She didn't seem to be aware that he'd entered until she finished a period. Then she turned her head. Kneel with me, she said. No, he said. Kneel, she said. You won't even need to speak to him yourself. Just kneel. Just make the first move. No, he said. I'm going. She didn't move, looking back and up at him. Joe, she said, will you stay? Will you do that much? Yes, he said. I'll stay, but make it fast. She prayed again. She spoke quietly with that abjectness of pride. When it was necessary to use the symbol words which he'd taught her, she used them. Spoke them forthright and without hesitation, talking to God as if he were a man in the room with two other men. She spoke of herself and of him as of two other people. Her voice still, monotonous, sexless. Then she ceased. She rose quietly. They stood in the twilight facing one another. This time she didn't even ask the question. He didn't even need to reply. After a time, she said quietly, Then there's just one other thing to do. There's just one other thing to do, he said. So now it's all done. All finished. He thought quietly, sitting in the dense shadow of the shrubbery, hearing the last stroke of the far clock cease and die away. It was the spot where he'd overtaken her, found her on one of the wild nights 2 years ago. But that was in another time, another life. Now it was still, quiet, the fecund earth now coolly suspirant. The dark was filled with the voices, myriad out of all time that he had known, as though all the past was a flat pattern, and going on. Tomorrow night, all the tomorrows, to be a part of the flat pattern going on. He thought of that with quiet astonishment. Going on, myriad, familiar, since all that had ever been was the same as all that was to be. since tomorrow to be and had been would be the same. Then it was time. He rose. He moved from the shadow and went around the house and entered the kitchen. The house was dark. He hadn't been to the cabin since early morning, and he didn't know if she'd left a note for him or not, expected him or not. Yet he didn't try for silence. It was as if he weren't thinking of sleep, of whether she would be asleep or not. He mounted the stairs steadily and entered the bedroom. Almost at once, she spoke from the bed. "Light the lamp," she said. "It won't need any light," he said. "Light the lamp." "No," he said. He stood over the bed. He held the razor in his hand, but it wasn't open yet. But she didn't speak again, and then his body seemed to walk away from him. It went to the table, and his hands laid the razor on the table and found the lamp and struck the match. She was sitting up in the bed, her back against the headboard. Over her nightdress, she wore a shawl drawn down across her breast. Her arms were folded upon the shawl, her hands hidden from sight. He stood at the table. They looked at one another. "Will you kneel with me?" she said. "I don't ask it." "No," he said. "I don't ask it. It's not I who ask it. Kneel with me." "No." They looked at one another. "Joe," she said, "for the last time, I don't ask it. Remember that. Kneel with me." "No," he said. Then he saw her arms unfold and her right hand come forth from beneath the shawl. It held an old-style single-action cap-and-ball revolver, almost as long and heavier than a small rifle. But the shadow of it and of her arm and hand on the wall didn't waver at all. The shadow of both monstrous, the cocked hammer monstrous, back-hooked and viciously poised like the arched head of a snake, it didn't waver at all. And her eyes didn't waver at all. They were as still as the round black ring of the pistol muzzle. But there was no heat in them, no fury. They were calm and still, as all pity and all despair and all conviction. But he wasn't watching them. He was watching the shadowed pistol on the wall. He was watching when the cocked shadow of the hammer flicked away. Standing in the middle of the road, with his right hand lifted full in the glare of the approaching car, he hadn't actually expected it to stop. Yet it did, with a squealing and sprawling suddenness that was almost ludicrous. It was a small car, battered and old. When he approached it, in the reflected glare of the headlights, two young faces seemed to float, like two soft-colored and aghast balloons. The nearer one, the girl's, back-shrunk in a soft, wide horror. But Christmas didn't notice this at the time. "How about riding with you, as far as you go?" he said. They said nothing at all, looking at him with that still and curious horror which he didn't notice. So he opened the door to enter the rear seat. When he did so, the girl began to make a choked wailing sound, which would be much louder in a moment, as fear gained courage, as it were. Already the car was in motion. It seemed to leap forward, and the boy, without moving his hands from the wheel or turning his head toward the girl, hissed, "Shut up! Hush! It's our only chance. Will you hush now?" Christmas didn't hear this either. He was sitting back now, completely unaware that he was riding directly behind desperate terror. He only thought with momentary interest that the small car was traveling at a pretty reckless speed for a narrow country road. "How far does this road go?" he said. The boy told him, naming the same town which the Negro boy had named to him on that afternoon 3 years ago, when he'd first seen Jefferson. The boy's voice had a dry, light quality. "You want to go there, Captain?" "All right," Christmas said. Yes, that'll do. That'll suit me. You going there?"
"Sure," the boy said in that light, flat tone.
"Wherever you say."
Again the girl beside him began that choked, murmurous, small animal-like moaning. Again the boy hissed at her, his face still rigidly front, the little car rushing and bouncing onward.
"Hush! Shh! Hush! Hush!"
But again Christmas didn't notice. He saw only the two young, rigidly forward-looking heads against the light glare, into which the ribbon of the road rushed swaying and fleeing. But he remarked both them and the fleeing road without curiosity. He wasn't even paying attention when he found that the boy had apparently been speaking to him for some time. How far they'd come or where they were, he didn't know. The boy's diction was slow now, recapitulant, each word as though chosen simply and carefully, and spoken slowly and clearly for the ear of a foreigner.
"Listen, Cap'n. When I turn off up here, it's just a shortcut. A short cut-off to a better road. I am going to take the cut-off. When I come to the shortcut, to the better road, so we can get there quicker. See?"
"All right," Christmas said. The car bounced and rushed on, swaying on the curves and up the hills and fleeing down again, as if the earth had dropped from under them. Mailboxes on posts beside the road rushed into the lights and flicked past. Now and then they passed a dark house. Again the boy was speaking.
"Now, this here cut-off I was telling you about is right down here. I'm going to turn into it, but it don't mean I am leaving the road. I'm just going a little way across to a better road, see?"
"All right," Christmas said. Then, for no reason, he said, "Hey, you must live around here somewhere." Now it was the girl who spoke. She turned in the seat, whirling, her small face wan with suspense and terror and blind and rat-like desperation.
"We do," she cried. "We both do, right up yonder. And when my pappy and brothers..."
Her voice ceased, cut short off. Christmas saw the boy's hand clapped upon her lower face and her hands tugging at the wrist, while beneath the hand itself her smothered voice choked and bubbled. Christmas sat forward.
"Here," he said, "I'll get out of here. You can let me out here."
"Now you've done it," the boy cried too, thinly, with desperate rage too.
"If you just kept quiet..."
"Stop the car," Christmas said. "I ain't going to hurt either of you. I just want to get out." Again the car stopped with sprawling suddenness. But the engine still raced, and the car leaped forward again before he was clear of the step. He had to leap forward running for a few steps to recover his balance. As he did so, something heavy and hard struck him on the flank. The car rushed on, fading at top speed. From it floated back the girl's shrill wailing. Then it was gone. The darkness, the now impalpable dust, came down again, and the silence beneath the summer stars. The object which had struck him had delivered an appreciable blow. Then he discovered that the object was attached to his right hand. Raising the hand, he found that it held the ancient heavy pistol. He didn't know that he had it. He didn't remember having picked it up at all, nor why. But there it was. "And I flagged that car with my right hand," he thought. "No wonder she... they..." He drew his right hand back to throw, the pistol balanced upon it. Then he paused, and he struck a match and examined the pistol in the puny dying glare. The match burned down and went out,
yet he still seemed to see the ancient thing with its two loaded chambers, the one upon which the hammer had already fallen, and which hadn't exploded, and the other upon which no hammer had yet fallen, but upon which a hammer had been planned to fall. "For her and for me," he said. His arm came back and through. He heard the pistol crash once through undergrowth. Then there was no sound again. "For her and for me."